Hi, friends. Welcome to the By Faith Podcast. I'm your host, Christine Hoover, and I'm so glad you're here. Each week this season, I'm talking with the guest about how they're using their unique gifts and talents in their specific context and season of life. My prayer for you is that by listening, you'll be encouraged, challenged, and equipped to step out by faith using your particular gifts for God's glory. Guys, do you know someone who is getting engaged or married this summer? All the questions and necessary conversations can become overwhelming in the engaged and newlywed time of life. How do we build a budget? Where will we live? When should we have kids? And what role does our faith play in all of this? Pastor Scott Kadersha has been helping couples navigate these important conversations and questions for more than 12 years, and he's put his best advice into a new book, Ready or Not, 12 Conversations Every Couple Needs to Have Before Marriage, covering topics such as communication, finances, sex, and in-laws. Ready or Not, that's K-N-O-T, is the perfect book for couples who want their relationship to last a lifetime. Learn more at scottkadersha.com/ready. Guys, my guest on By Faith today is Kim Ranselman. Kim is a writer, a mom, and a wife to a Texas high school football coach. So you know we had to talk about Texas football and Friday Night Lights right out of the gate. Kim shares how she's intentional about living locally right where she is and how she's come to see people not as interruptions, but as an opportunity to serve. And that includes the people in her family, aka kids, as well as the football players on her husband's team. She is honest in this conversation about how she's struggled to fight isolation as an introvert and resentment when her husband is working so much and hasn't been able to help her. For anyone feeling a sense of lack, whether it's financially, spiritually, physically, or emotionally, Kim's story will encourage you. And if you're like me, it's going to convict you in a really good way. Here, friends, is my conversation with Kim Ranselman. I am excited to welcome Kim Ranselman. Am I saying that right?
That's no. So close. Ranselman.
Ranselman. It doesn't look like that on paper. It
does not look like that on paper.
Ranselman.
Right.
Good job. Okay. Good. Welcome to the podcast.
As we tell people, just call me Kim. Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Drop it. It's fine. Don't worry about it.
Hi, Kim.
Hi.
I'm excited to get to talk to you. I've never gotten to talk to you before, but you were recommended to me by an Instagram follower. And when I got on and looked up some of your writing and who you were, I was like, I have to talk to this person. I'm so excited.
Mm-hmm. Love that. Thanks. Yeah. I'm thrilled to be on here. Thanks so much, Christine.
Yeah. Well, tell me where you are and what you do and about your family.
So most of my days right now are spent getting prepared for an adoption that we're doing. So I'm a wife and a mom, of three daughters who are grown. I have 28, 23, and 21-year-olds. And then we've been in the middle of adopting a little 13-year-old girl from Eastern Europe. This is 6.5 years of trying to adopt a girl.
6.5 years?
I know, it's ridiculous.
Whole
another story, right? But it's almost done. So we'll be able to bring her home by early February.
So really, like it's official, it's happening.
Like the court is passed.
Congratulations.
Thanks. I know, we're hugely thrilled. So my middle daughter who lives with us calls me in the nesting phase, and she's so right. Like everything's being cleaned out, organized, put together, you know, all the IKEA furniture is up, and I'm having a great time actually kind of creating a space for her finally. Through all those 6 years, we had to do home study visits, so we had to show we had a place for her 4 times, but none of them, everything felt iffy, and this is the first time it really feels like, yeah, this is it. So we're hugely thrilled that this is finally happening. So
that's probably very surreal too, after that long.
It absolutely is. In fact, somebody just asked me whether it feels real. And I will say, for the first time in a long time, it really, really does. Like the first time we filed, it felt very real. We thought this would be happening within a year, you know, that sort of thing. And that felt real. And then it stopped, you know, everything. That, again, that's a whole long story. But it does feel real for the first time in a really long time. And I'm so grateful.
Okay, so I'm thinking about this. You started the process when all three of your girls were still at home.
All three. Yeah. My oldest was just finishing up college. when we were doing this, but my other two were at home. Yeah.
So you thought, we'll add another child to the mix and just keep on moving. And now you're kind of starting over.
Yeah. Way starting over. Like my youngest daughter is off at university. She's entering her senior year of school. So we will have like this backup, right? Of like being in the teen years. It's so funny that again, this isn't why this isn't what we were supposed to talk about, but it is funny how the Lord, we were so set that we were done for the rest of our lives. And then 2 weeks later, God was like, that's so funny how you make things like that. You know that Jeremiah verse? I always have this verse is like, I know the plans I have for me, declares the Kim. These are plans that will prosper me and not harm me and give me a future and a hope. Yeah. And then God's like, here's some others. Here's some more plans.
So, that's funny. Okay. So where do you live?
We live in Central Texas, just 2 hours south of Dallas, an hour north of Austin on I-35, Temple.
You live in Temple. I'm from Texas.
Yeah, I heard that.
Yeah.
Texas.
I grew up in East Texas, Tyler.
Okay. Yeah. Been there. Tyler. My husband's a football coach, so we know every stadium in Texas. So.
Y'all played John Tyler then?
We either played them or just missed them in the playoffs. I can't remember since we've been here. Temple's a 6A school, so we see the bigger schools.
Wow. Okay, so have you seen Friday Night Lights, the TV show?
Do you know I never have? And my daughters always laugh because, like, why would you watch your life on replay? Like,
exactly.
It is. I always tell people, no matter how dramatic they make it, no matter how ridiculous Texas football scenes, you have no idea how
ridiculous it is. That is exactly. I tell people they get it right in a lot of ways. Like when you watch that, you're going to think, because I live in Virginia, and I tell people when you watch that, you're going to think that is not real, but it is real. That happens. Like the booster who's at practice and
just one is on the practice. They don't line the field. Is that that's not right? That's not how it should go. Yeah, the original Friday Night Lights book was based on, so I'm originally from West Texas, near the Odessa Permian High School region where the whole thing was set off. And every time when I would read the book, I was like, oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But that's Freetown in Texas. That's not Odessa's problem. This is our, it's, you know, roll up the streets, the football game's on. So yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's great fun when you're winning and you have job security. It's not so great when you're losing. So.
Yeah, on the TV show, he comes home to find for sale signs in his yard when they
leave. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, in this town. Absolutely.
That's got to be a lot of pressure.
Yeah, we're all on year-to-year contracts. So every year, every February, you find out whether you have another job again in this town. So it's tough. It's not an easy life.
Do you work as well?
So just writing. I do contract writing, mostly for my church. Wrote the children's curriculum and write Bible studies for women and things like that. So mostly contract writing.
Okay. Well, the reason why I wanted to talk to you is because you, from the person who recommended you to me, she used a word that has struck a nerve with me over the past year. She said that you live very intentionally at the local level. Mm-hmm. And a word that I've been thinking a lot about is being embodied, mm-hmm. that God has placed me in a body, in a location, in a family, mm-hmm. in a certain community where he wants me to serve. Yeah. And that has struck a chord with me because I think that we're living in a time where we don't think about that enough, mm-hmm. and we can get really confused about what God would have us to do and how to serve. And so I would love for you to speak to that a little bit about how you have thought or how you've come to this idea of really trying to be intentional about mm-hmm. living locally.
Yeah. Well, you're just quoting Acts 17, right? Like when Paul is talking in Athens and the philosophers come to him, he says, we have this God who has determined the allotted time periods and the dwellings of the places in which men will be. And he did that for a reason, so that we may search for him, feel our way for him and find him. Not that he's far from us, he wants us to know, because in him we live and move and have our being. He's quick to tell us, but That idea, the very first time I read this, was struck me so hard. It was one of the very first verses. I didn't come to faith in Christ until I was late 20s. So reading the Bible was brand new to me. And when I read that, it was actually so helpful. We were in the middle of our 11th move in 10 years, kind of a thing. And I was really struggling as a brand new believer with what was all this about, and why this sense of separation and loneliness and constant upheaval. But to read that there was this intentionality to it, that God was moving me on purpose for this allotted time. You're going to live here for this allotted time. And so after all those moves, we've actually been the same house since 2000. So 18 years in the same home. Before that, I wasn't in a home more than a year. Hmm. So we were never in a town more than 3 years before we landed here. And so while I'm grateful for that, this is my allotted time and this is my allotted place. And so it was up to me, every one of those moves, to really be intentional as God was intentional toward me. So he was intentional to move me as I needed to move to feel my way toward him. But now it's my responsibility as his ambassador of reconciliation to help those around me who have been placed here around me to feel their way toward him, to find him, because he's not far off through his church, especially. Mm-hmm. So it's really important to see ourselves the way Paul writes to us in Acts 17, that this is your time, this is your place, and these are your people. This right now, right around you, these are your opportunities that you're living in. Mm-hmm. And so the idea of actually being where you are is really important. That wherever our Jerusalem, then to Samaria, then to Judea, then to the ends of the earth, is very much my neighborhood, my local, my county, my state, my world, and not the reverse. It's so easy to sweetly reach out to people just like you across the world, even. But to find commonality through our simply being together is really important to Paul and really important to God, because mm-hmm. he did with Christ, intentionally located him.
Yes, that's a good something that I have thought with this, is that Jesus himself had a body and Jesus himself had a place where he laid his head, although it was different mm-hmm. most nights, right? But he had certain people that he was interacting with, and that's very freeing to me to think about that, because I think mm-hmm. a lot of times we do the opposite. We think first about the outer ends of the earth and we think last about our neighborhood or mm-hmm. our family members, maybe even.
Well, it's messier, isn't it? It's messier. Like, it's so much easier to pray for the nations than to pray for my family. Mm-hmm. It's so much easier to engage with a woman who is seeking me even for counsel than to engage with my own daughters in their teens and 20s. Who honestly couldn't care less and have heard this 1,000 times. It's so much harder to engage in a neighbor who, we have new neighbors in our neighborhood, and I've tried to do those kind of crossing routes. Do you know what I mean? Where I see her out, so I intentionally, right, pass by, and zero, absolutely no engagement whatsoever. Like, she couldn't care less about me, weirdly. and that it's so much easier to think about those that we've love in Eastern Europe after traveling there to see our daughter 15 times. I've fallen in love with people across the world. They're so easy to engage with that I it's so easy to think about them and to reach toward them and to be purposeful toward them in a way that the neighbors can make it very, very challenging.
I think social media is a big issue with this as well. I find myself even literally leaving my body, my mind going elsewhere by looking at, let's say, Instagram or something like that with these people I do not know, but I feel like I know because I follow them and I, you know, listen.
Well, and they let themselves be knowable. Again, mm-hmm. so much easier, it's so much less messy to engage with somebody who is like you. And now with the Enneagram face, is that even how you say it? You know, where you can type yourself and like look up your own types and match yourself to these types and find your commonality. We're all finding these little enclaves that are mirror reflections of us that we like. These people are like us. I resonate with her. And so it not only that, our whole world, I'll never forget the first time I read, I think it was John Piper who said that Facebook will one day be used against us to show that prayerlessness was not for lack of time. Yeah, he's so good at like just playing me open. But that idea is also true for, we don't have a lack of time for discipleship. We don't have a lack of time to meet our neighbors. We have a lack of longing. We have a lack of intentionality, lack of discipline. We have a lack of self-control, but mostly we just have a lack of discipleship in doing so. I don't know that there's a great deal of talk that pushes us out of our circles and into other areas and other spheres that are not ours.
So how are you personally fighting against that push toward being disembodied? How are you cultivating a very localized ministry?
I want you to know, first of all, this is really challenging for me. I am what, like, I think the types would call an extroverted introvert. Like, my default is alone, silence, personal reflection, writing, studying. Like, me alone in a dark room is just like my sweet spot. So even having kids is like challenging for me. Like, they follow you. They follow you in your 20s. They still gravitate toward the room I'm in. And no matter what, they're still right there. And so I think one of the most important things is, even with your kids, but especially with your kids probably, and your husband, but your neighbors, all the people in your life, they are not interruptions. They are your opportunity. Galatians 6 is really the key, like, way I would format everything you're thinking around it. It says, as far as you have opportunity, do good to all people, especially those of the household of faith. So God has this longing for us to take advantage of the opportunities that he's giving us, but it's in an especially way. He has an especially kind of love for his people, an especially kind of intentionality about his people. And he wants that mimicked in us, within our homes, within our churches. But there's plenty more resources and energy to be given for those outside. It doesn't mean that he holds the best. He's very lavish with his world, but not as he's lavish with his church. And that's this model that he's wanting for us. So when I go into my room and sit down in my dark corner, and all three girls plus a granddaughter now follow me in, and that's either an interruption or an opportunity. And it's my job to see them as having more value, more significance, more dignity, to be admired in them than whatever it was I thought I wanted, whatever I thought would feed me the best. God knows better than I do. And he's fully capable of keeping daughters away from mothers if he thinks I need a minute. But if they're following after me and I cannot escape them, which is most days, then that's my opportunity. And it's up to me to change my idea of what my resources are in that moment. Because there were days when I was in my 30s, probably especially in my 30s, where I would wake up tired because I knew how little sleep I got. I would wake up aware of how little money I had, how much little time I had, how little my schedule allowed. I was homeschooling. Football season, you know, is that 120 hours a week. You know, we're eating dinner together as a family one night a week during football season. It's still true. One night a week we get dinner together. And the rest of the time is spent on other people's kids. And so there was a real sense of lack in me. But it actually was one elder in our church who saw me one day alone. It was playoffs. And most of the time in Texas, Sunday mornings are not taken. Usually husbands can go to church with their wives. And that's usually not a problem, but playoffs bring a whole different level of madness to the state. And it was on Sunday. I was walking in with three small kids and had barely gotten us there. And I'm feeling really frazzled and pretty bitter about my lack of opportunities to do what I wanted to do. And this elder passed by me and he said, "Is Wayne working?" "Yeah, he is." And I was ready to just pass by. And he said, "I just want you to know, like, I cannot tell you what a difference coaches make in the lives of these men." Like, my son will not listen to anyone, but he quotes his coaches to me all day long. And he walked on from that conversation like nothing had happened. And I realized that I had thought of football as an interruption. Football was interrupting my life. It was interrupting my plans, my goal, my day, my schedule. In fact, I had a sign that literally said, "We interrupt this family for football season." Like that. Because this every coach's wife is like, because that's what happens. But I didn't see it as I see it now. I did not see those boys as our opportunity, not his opportunity, our opportunity. I didn't know their names. I realized that. I knew what position he was coaching at the time, linebackers. I don't know their names. I don't know the numbers. I'm going to the games, but I'm going because that's where he is and it's the only way to see him. And all of that meant that I saw people as interruptions to my life. They were not the opportunities of God to reach the nations through Judea, through Jerusalem, not just the outer ends of the earth, but to reach the nations through Jerusalem. He didn't need to save the nations by simply giving people a heart for the nations. When he wanted the nations reached, he just stoned Stephen and they scattered. So these people that we are discipling can be the uttermost parts of the earth if he so chooses. All I have to do is be faithful right here. Jesus was faithful within 30 miles and that reached the ends of the earth. I only have to do right here. And the whole ends of the earth thing does not need to get off my radar.
So that day when that elder said that to you and it kind of changed your perspective, how did you then begin to engage those boys on the team?
They had to have faces and names. They needed to. Dr. Carl Ellis spoke at a conference in Desiring God. I think his talk is called "The Sovereignty of God in Ethnic-Based Suffering." But that talk helped me so much because it helped me to see that one of my biases was towards me, towards myself, towards those that look like me, towards establishing my own life, towards gathering my people around me, and not gathering around me the people God was giving to me. And my entry into people not like me is Texas high school football. So they now have names. This is not just number, the receivers are number 1, 2, 3, 5, 6. They have these numbers. Now they're not. Now they're Montavian, they're Clinton, they're Bobby, they're Nathan. They have names and they have faces and they have stories and they have lives. And that's what changed, was that I started getting personal. So the clerks in the store, they have names and they have backstories and they matter. They're not just there to serve me and get me out of there as fast as possible. I have this like article written that I've never sent in, but it's called "Get Out of Your Car." We can drive through everywhere and you can now drive through your groceries. You can actually leave the marketplaces. Paul spoke to the Athenians in the marketplace. He had to get out of his place and go to the market. And the markets all over the world are the places where people cross. But we have found a way to have us cross ourselves with one person putting groceries in the trunk of my car. So it's really easy to take advantage of all that we have now to isolate yourself completely. You don't have to pass by people. You don't have to engage with people. You don't have to get your cart stuck in an aisle on the day before Thanksgiving. You can bypass all this and just get your job done, which is to get Thanksgiving dinner made. Or wake up 30 minutes earlier and go to the store and see people and find out who is weeping and who is angry and who is irritable and who is rejoicing, and meet their eyes and make yourself available to the opportunities that God would have. But our world is set up to deny us. So it really is being countercultural to all of the ways that technology is opening us up to not having to engage with the actual physical flesh and blood people that we have. We deliberately don't have a mailbox at our house. We use the neighborhood mailbox cluster. I don't know if your neighborhoods have that now, but so many on our block have put up mailboxes. They don't have to go walk down half a block to get their mail. But we deliberately do not, despite my girls longing all of their lives for us to not have to walk down thing to get the mail. I'm like, just take a walk and just take a walk and see who you see. But it is fighting against it. And it's, but again, this is hard for me personally. Like I have this bent towards not being with people, much less, but it is engaging against all the ways that keep you isolated.
Mm-hmm. So how do you fight that personal sense of just wanting to be isolated, wanting to be in your corner? What are some of the things that you kind of truths that you speak to yourself about that?
There is a sense in which I feel like when I was younger, I thought that self-care, which is a big word right now, meant like knowing your traits, knowing your tendencies, and kind of like taking the time and the space that you need to have that. I am not against physical, spiritual, emotional, psychological health. Do not hear me say that. But I have learned that just because you got 2 hours of sleep doesn't mean you won't have enough energy to get through the day, because the Lord is sweet like that. You could actually get 12 hours of sleep and not feel energized at all. I've learned that God's resources for us are far greater than we know. And I mean his physically sustaining us, his financially sustaining us. My talk bank can get really filled up pretty fast. And I think I can't be around more people. I don't want to be around more people. I want all you people to go away. And then I realized when I have this image, as soon as I said that, I have this image of Jesus saying to the disciples, get in the boat, let's escape the crowds, let's go to the other side. And they did. And the people ran around and met him there. And right there, he gave us a hint for how to break through that. He said that when he saw the crowds, he had compassion because they were like sheep without a shepherd. So he stayed until it was late in the day, teaching and healing. That idea of do you have compassion on the needs of others? I found myself looking at my emotional withdrawals, my low bank of what I had, my resources, and not at their low bank, and not seeing Christ and the fullness of the Holy Spirit, the fullness of the sufficiency of the Word, to meet me there, to give me all that I need to do his will. And so if my girls come in and I'm at the end of it and it's football season, I call it October. My friends know that if they say, it doesn't matter if it's September, if they say, how's it going this season? I say it's October. October is a hard month for us because it's not playoffs, so it doesn't really matter. But it's not new, so it's no longer exciting. It's just October football, which means they're gone and this is ridiculous. And I get this real like emotional lull in the midst of that. And I think I know what I need. I need my husband home. I need time with him. I need date nights. I need somebody to watch the kids. I need somebody to help me with this house. I need better meal planning. The finances are low. Everything's low in October. And I see my lack so strongly. And I remember Jesus trying to escape the pressing needs. And he always had compassion. And that sense of compassion was this willingness to so count on the sufficiency of God that you could get up early, stay up late, pour yourself out, and start all over the next day, trusting in God to give me every word that I need to speak, everything that I need to give. Whatever I need, my Father will supply it. He will supply all of my need according to his glorious riches in Jesus. It's just that I don't wake up believing that. And so it's learning more and more to count on it.
That's so good. I read in Hannah Anderson's new book, All That's Good. The one thing that stuck out to me from that is that we tend to have a scarcity mentality.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
We're always kind of protective of ourselves. That is so me. And everything you're just saying, I feel like is something God is pressing on with me.
And Luke 6 tells us, give and it will be given to you, pressed down, shaken together, poured forth into your lap so much that you can't even contain it. But it starts with give. It doesn't start with count and save. We're so about last time this happened, I did not have enough money in the bank. This time, we got to start with a bigger barn before we're going to be able to say we're supplied. We got to start with more. I got to have more behind me. But honestly, it also just takes, the older your kids get, the less able you are to do anything at all well. And so that's really helpful if you haven't gotten there yet. The teen years and the adolescent years are humbling and exhausting, but one thing they teach you is that you don't have what it takes. And yet God is so sweet to just do these things, which you cannot do with so little that you bring to the table. But there are these life lessons along the way that just teach you that the word we use in our house is unnecessary. Like I always say to them, I get to die because you have no idea how unnecessary I am to all that you've been given. Like how little part I had and what you count on as the spiritual blessings from our family. That's like, I was like this and God supplied. And so whether it's time or whether it's energy or whether it's sleep or whether it's finances or home, we still live in the same 1,200 square foot home as we've ever lived since we got here. And now we just have 15 football players in it every Monday. And they go everywhere and they eat everything. But if we run out of food, they love ramen. So they're all fine. And water from the tap is great. And sometimes I can make big meals because my food budget is huge. And sometimes it's not. And I need to rely on the body of Christ to come supply me so that I can supply them. And other times they eat ramen and they don't have Gatorade. They get water and ramen, and they know where it is and they can make it themselves.
Mm-hmm. I love that.
You stop worrying about what it looks like because one night it just falls apart and it can't be anything. The boys were at my house the day I got the call that my brother had a brain tumor. They were at my house the day I had to go to be with him in the ICU, and they were at my house whenever we found out I had to leave him because he was dying. Like, it's okay to have them all in my house at the worst possible times. And during those times, they got ramen. Like, they didn't get steak, they get ramen. And you learn they're actually happy to be with us, not to just be fed.
Okay, so my next question was about discipleship, but you just described discipleship before I even asked it, right? I mean, because this is one thing I really have wanted to talk about on my podcast this season is what does discipleship look like and how do we do that practically in our life? Do you think that what you just described, do you say that's what discipleship is?
Yeah, that's it. Just inviting people into your life every part of the way. And again, like, it is not about trying to teach lessons all the way through it. It's simply being where you are. If you were to follow our story with Lyra, is on Instagram at, like, there's a hashtag that we created for, just so we could keep all the posts under one for these 6 years. And, there's some really yucky posts in there where I tell people, I have nothing to offer you. He's dark, I'm ticked, and I got nothing. So, Selah. Like, I have nothing. The end. And but I think it's important that people know that I am actually comfortable not being okay with God because his people have not been okay with him all along the way. Like, how long, O Lord, is a question he gets all day, every day from the martyrs. How long? In other words, what are you doing? When are you going to stop this? I'm not the first. I will not be the last to shake my head at him in wonderment. They were real. They were real people who lived like us. And even when it's my sin that causes it, Micah said, he's still going to be a light to me. So allowing people to see your willingness to go there with him when it's good times or bad is a huge part of discipleship. And if you can invite women, you know, women have their own lives, so they can't follow me around like Peter followed Jesus, right? But they can, but social media is great for that. Text messages are great for that. When people say, how are you? Be honest. And if you know some light in it, feel free to share it. But oftentimes I leave most of the women in my life just like hanging. Like, well, they end up messaging me back. Like that friend who wrote to you about me, she'll message me back and go, well, do you have any hope there? And I'll say, not today. Not today, sweetie. Not today. Mm. But not today. Mm-hmm. I said, I always tell them, I'll let you know. I'll let you know.
It'll eventually come. I'll eventually have some. Okay, so really getting into the lives of others, I'm imagining these football players over at your house Monday. This is not glamorous at all. And I think sometimes we think that ministry and whatever God calls us to is going to be somehow this like glowing, glamorous thing.
I always think, if you read the Bible, you're gonna be disabused of that notion very, very quickly.
Yes. So can you help us understand what true servanthood looks like?
I think one of the things, the most important part of that word is servant. Like, you have to keep in mind servanthood. And servants don't have a lot of self-esteem, self-rights, self-privileges, self-aggrandization. Like, we're not worried about ourselves. We're worrying, is what I'm doing helping them? And it's not helping them meet our goals. Servants don't have goals for their masters. Servants serve what their master's goals are. That doesn't mean that we follow people in righteousness. I'm not handing out money so they can go, you know, buy beer one weekend or something. But there is a sense in which if they have a goal, then my job as a servant is to help them meet that goal. And that might also be trying to help them see new goals, try and dream bigger and better and equipping them for that. But the real word of servanthood keeps us grounded, and it keeps us grounded in Christ. So understanding that it's, you know, a servant is never greater than their master. So you have to lower yourself, but not by pushing yourself down, but by raising in your estimation others. How much dignity do they have to you? How significant are they to you? How much superior are they than you? What do you know about them that is superior to you? What do they do better than you do? What do you admire about them? It's so hard when we're passing by. There's one scene I have in my head from a couple of nights ago, late night trip to Walmart. And there was a woman who had had it with her kids. Just, she was at the end, and it was late at night. It's so easy for us to think, well, then what are your kids doing out this late anyway? If you would get some sleep and they would get some sleep, and why are you yelling at them? That's not going to help. As if we've never done this. As if we've never had their kids out or past their point for our own benefit. As if we've never pushed their lack of sleep out for our own gain. As if I've never had my kids out at 1 a.m. for a football game. But it's so easy for me to judge what she's doing. But I needed to see her as having value and significance and dignity and being superior to me in many aspects by knowing my own weaknesses. C.J. Mahaney once said, when you enter the room, you are the biggest sinner that you know. Because you are familiar with all of your sin. I just got one glimpse of one of hers. But I should be walking into that store with a full knowledge of my own sinfulness. That understanding myself and my raising in estimation others keeps me at the servanthood word. Mm. And I cannot emphasize that enough. There is a sense in which I think we come to serving others with a real, what can we do for them? How can we help them? It's a real like self-fulfilling thing.
Yeah.
Rather than what do they need? What is their lack? And how is there any way that I can just raise their arms so they're not quite so tired today? Mm-hmm. Is there any way I can fulfill this lack so they're more supplied today? Is there any way in which they could feel more encouraged because they saw me? So it's important that we keep ourselves like real grounded in our lack, our inability. Pick that sin that you have not even engaged in. You just keep doing it, and you're not happy with it, and you could write a Bible study on why you shouldn't be doing this, but you're still doing it. And watch yourself there, and watch yourself closely there, so that when you see somebody else giving into their sin, whatever the sin is, you're like, oh, yeah, me and you. No temptation is seizing you, buddy, except what's common in me. And our God is still faithful to provide us a way out so that we can stand under it. But you have to know you're tempted. I'm tempted as that mother is every single day. Lose it. Lose the sense of dignity and value in my kids and just turn them over to my own needs. That's me every day. Mm. So I think that's really, really important.
Yeah, that's good. Well, Kim, I appreciate your time today. It was so fun to get to meet you.
So glad to as well.
And I guess y'all are done with football season. So now you're enjoying.
Thanks be to God. Football season. And here we go. You know how that is. Like Friday night, we lost. Once you lose on a Friday night, it's like, and it's basketball season. It's great.
Does he coach basketball too?
He does coach basketball as well. and track as well. So here we are. So
wow.
Into it to the other. So, but we do get this little break called bringing Lyra home. So I'm grateful.
Yay! Congratulations. I hope that's a wonderful time for y'all as a family.
Yeah.
Join me next week, friends, as we wrap up this current season of By Faith. My husband, Kyle, is going to join me to answer your questions on my Ask Me Anything episode. I always love recording with my husband, one, because I love him, but also I think he is one of the wisest people I know. I also love answering your questions that you send in, so please join me next week for the Ask Me Anything episode. All right, friends, until then, have a great week and keep walking forward by faith.